This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and we begin today with the family separation crisis and its ongoing impact on the children. In just a moment, we'll look at ProPublica's investigation into allegations of sexual abuse at immigration detention centers housing children. But we begin at the Shiloh Treatment Center in Manville, Texas. According to federal court documents filed in late April of this year, migrant children were forcibly injected with psychiatric drugs at the detention facility, which is south of Houston, without their consent. And on Monday, a federal judge intervened, ordering the government to stop drugging migrant children without proper consent. U.S. District Judge Dolly G. in Los Angeles also ruled that the children housed at Shiloh be moved into less restrictive housing, except for those deemed by licensed professionals to pose, quote, a risk of harm to themselves or others. Aura Bogado is an immigration reporter for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting, who helped break the story of abuse at the Shiloh Treatment Center. Aura, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tanzina. Thank you for having me.
So let's take a step back and tell us a little bit about the Shiloh Treatment Facility. How long has it been around? And is this practice of administering drugs, did that start before the current migrant crisis? Or is that something that was implemented when these children arrived?
Shiloh's been around for a while, but it started housing unaccompanied minors in 2013. And that entire time, yes, it has drugged the unaccompanied minors that have been in its care.
And what type of drugs are we talking about? And how do they make the decision to drug these children? Are they psychotropic? Are they physical? You know, for ailments? What are we talking about here?
They're really, really heavy drugs. They're psychotropic drugs that are prescribed for people who are dealing with pretty serious mental health issues. We also know that sometimes children are prescribed other drugs that are used for Parkinson's patients, for example, have sometimes been administered at Shiloh. And in the case of Shiloh, there is a psychiatrist on site. We recently broke the story that psychiatrist, that Dr. Javier Ruiz, had in fact lost his certification for child and adolescent psychiatry. So although his license remained intact, he lost the certification to treat children and adolescents, which is what Shiloh houses. And he was the one who was prescribing the drugs. The way that the children wound up there is that they were in a shelter like the regular shelters that we've been hearing a lot about, and they were stepped up, the processes stepped up in the system that they're in, which is the Office of Refugee Resettlement under Health and Human Services. So ORR finds something in their behavior, whether it's heavy crying, depression. There was one child who had heard that his mom became very, very sick back home in Guatemala, and so he peed in his pants. And depending on the determination that ORR makes, they are then placed within a place like Shiloh.
And is it fair to say, you know, to a certain extent, these are children, as you described, who are essentially experiencing trauma, whether that's from coming across the way they came to the United States, what they encountered when they got to the United States. So is it possible to say that the folks who are administrating these drugs are doing it to help these children?
That's ostensibly the case, and I don't doubt that some drug may have helped some child, but overwhelmingly what we know from court records and also from families that I've spoken with, they say that the drugs are used in order to control children's behavior to the point of being just completely silenced and under control. And children also say that sometimes they don't want to take the drugs because they don't like the way that the drugs make them feel, and they've been forcibly held down and injected. It's important also to keep in mind that Shiloh, before Shiloh existed, it had a different name, Daystar. There are three deaths that are associated with the same sort of entity that runs Daystar and Shiloh. Although none of the children who died there were unaccompanied minors, it does sort of bring into question the safety of any child there.
Let's also, you actually spoke to a young boy and his mother. Her name is Maribel. The boy was in Shiloh from November of last year to April of this year. And according to medical records that you were able to access during his time there, he was given drugs without his mother's consent. And this is, again, at the Shiloh Center. So let's take a listen to what his mother, Maribel, had to tell you.
Nunca autoricé, es más.
I never authorized it. In fact, when I found out he was so sleepy, like hypnotized, inarticulate, I called and I asked his staff person if they could take away that medication. And she told me, no, no one can take away that medication because it has been prescribed by the doctor and that my child needed it. And I asked her, can I not, as the mother, decide for my child not to be giving all the medication? And she said that no one could discontinue the medication, only the doctor. She said it just like that.
Ahora, tell us about Maribel and her son.
Maribel was already in the United States. She was living in New Orleans. Her son, for a variety of reasons, really wanted to be with her. They were both originally from Honduras. He came to the United States with his cousin, and him and his cousin were separated at the border last year in 2017. And he was in a shelter and really wanted to run away and be with his mom, as children tend to want to do. And because of that and some other behaviors, he was then referred to a psychiatrist within the ORR system. That psychiatrist deemed that he should be placed under certain medication, and Maribel's son wound up at Shiloh. The entire time that this was happening, the government knew exactly where Maribel was. They knew that because she is in the system. She is actively seeking asylum right now and has an open case. And they did not hand him over to her. And once he went in there, she just describes a really big shift in the way that he was communicating with her. She would sometimes video chat with him through WhatsApp. And she noticed that he just looked sometimes very, very, very tired. She describes him as lethargic, and she really just wanted him out. And for nearly 6 months, they refused to do so.
Now, there has been some movement on this case. And since your reporting, we've seen, for example, Monday of this week, a federal judge intervened and ordered the government to stop drugging immigrant children without proper consent. What exactly entails consent? Consent from whom? Parents who may or may not be available?
Yeah, this is a really good question. I think that this ruling, probably some parts of it are still going to be have to be hammered out. They are technically in the care and custody of ORR. And a lot of times the children do have parents or a potential sponsor that hasn't yet fully been vetted by ORR's system. So we'll see who that means. It may mean the child themselves, but sometimes the child is very, very young. In the case of Maribel's son, for example, he was only 9 years old when he was there. So what does consent look like? The ruling also says that the children need to be taken out of there unless they pose a risk of harm to themselves or others. And I know from Twitter, some people were saying, well, they're all a risk. That's why they're there. That's not necessarily the case. Again, they're referred there for a whole bunch of different reasons, and it doesn't always have to do with the fact that they may harm themselves. It just has to do with the fact that they may be depressed. And again, these are children, as you pointed out, that are often dealing with very, very, very heavy trauma. They're leaving a situation in their home countries where they have sometimes witnessed horrific things, children who have seen massacres, children whose lives have been threatened. They, through a miracle, sometimes find their way to the border and then talk about essentially being re-traumatized in places like Shiloh.
Aura Abogado is an immigration reporter for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Aura, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanzina.
Allegations of drugging in migrant detention centers are emerging alongside stories of sexual abuse. Just this week, an employee at a Southwest Key facility in Phoenix was arrested for alleged sexual abuse, child molestation, and aggravated assault of a 14-year-old girl being detained at the center. Now, a new investigation by ProPublica attempts to chronicle these reports of abuse. Reporters Michael Grable and Topher Sanders obtained police reports and call logs dating back to 2014 from more than two-thirds of the shelters housing immigrant children. I spoke with Topher Sanders about what they found.
There were 126 call logs that reflected some type of sexual offense. That number is looking at just the documents that we could tie directly to unaccompanied children. That number could be as high as 300 plus when you look at the facilities that take care of a hybrid of children, children that are in general foster care from the United States, and they also have beds for people who are unaccompanied. Texas houses the majority of these children, and many of the records that would tell the full picture reside in Texas, and we haven't gotten those records yet.
Runaways and sexual abuse, like, is this something that happens at these facilities systemically? Is this something that children who are placed in these facilities, whether they're migrant children or not migrant children, are exposed to?
Yeah, that's a great question. We heard it from a lot of people as it relates to, well, isn't this just like foster care? Isn't that the analogy you would make? And in foster care, aren't there kind of horrible things that happen? And there's a little bit of truth to that. Yes, they are analogous to foster care. It's essentially the type of system they set up to house these young people. But they also bring the added challenges and complexity of being children who are in a completely new environment. They're housed with people that speak different languages or from different countries. In some instances, there's no adult staff member at these facilities that even speak the dialect of some of these children. And what the experts and psychologists tell us is that because of these circumstances, because the children are weighing whether or not speaking up will jeopardize their opportunity to remain in this country, this group of children are far less likely to voice any abuse that they experience or to tell an adult that, hey, I saw this happening to my friend and my roommate. That's less likely to happen with this group of children.
So, Topher, let me ask you. On Tuesday, during a Senate judiciary hearing, Senator Rich Blumenthal, who's the Democrat from Connecticut, pose these questions to a panel of Trump administration officials.
Let me ask this panel, who here thinks that zero tolerance has been a success? You can just raise your hand if you think it's been a success. Who thinks that the family separation policy has been a success? Raise your hand.
None of the witnesses raised their hands. And in your opinion, does this administration and do members of Congress really understand or care about the ramifications of this process ultimately?
I think you kind of have to assess, as a voter, assess the actions of your lawmakers to make that determination for yourself. But we did hear from lawmakers that were alarmed by what we found, which indicated they did not know and had not been told by anybody what the kind of sum total of this world looks like. And again, we only have a fraction of that we've reported. We have more to report and a fuller picture still out there to be learned.
Topher Sanders, reporter for ProPublica. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Getting good mental health care in the United States can be hard, even for those with health insurance and financial resources. But if you're a person of color, live in a struggling neighborhood, and don't have insurance, well, the mental health care picture becomes pretty bleak. And that's the case in much of Chicago, where the mental health care system has been devastated in the last few years under the leadership of Rahm Emanuel and an Illinois state budget standoff. All week here on The Takeaway, we've been exploring the intersection of race, place, and health with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And for our final piece today, we turn to two people working in Chicago on the front lines of mental health care. Angela Cedeno is the executive director of the Kedzie Center, which aims to provide accessible, culturally informed, and quality mental health care to residents of neighborhoods including Albany Park, Irving Park, and North Park. And Jonathan Foyles is a writer and mental health professional who also works out of Chicago. I asked Angela to tell me what mental health issues she's seeing in the neighborhoods her organization serves.
We're seeing a full range of mental health issues, including depression, suicidality, anxiety, High amounts of intergenerational trauma, secondary to domestic violence, histories of abuse, exposure to violence. We have a large number of families that are coming from other countries with trauma histories due to persecution, poverty, torture, sexual exploitation, and exposure to violence.
Yeah, the thing that strikes me more and more when I work in the community that I serve is how much of our therapeutic interventions and the things that we know how to do to help people, how much those are based on sort of a stereotypical middle class suburban type experience. You know, one of the things I learned in grad school, one of the things that I personally find beneficial to help people kind of snap out of a depression is to get outside more. You know, whether that's walk in a park, go and do some activities, go to the library, that sort of thing. You know, and I recommend this to my clients, and I still do. But, you know, I've had more than a few say, well, you know, I've seen three people get shot across my building, you know, in the past like 2 or 3 months. And if you think that I'm going to willingly go outside any more than I have to, then you should better think again. That just points to a larger issue of sort of the chronic underdevelopment in these communities. You know, again, one of the things that we like to do as therapists is refer people to their natural resources, whether that's participating in their local community schools, you know, being part of community neighborhood clubs, you know, working in the neighborhood. But a lot of these options through, you know, white flight and systematic disinvestment just aren't available to the communities that I serve and that the Kedzie Center serves. You know, 50 schools were closed a couple of years ago here. You know, we know schools are sort of a essential neighborhood component. It's something that brings people together and it's usually in a peaceful manner. You know, that's gone in a lot of places. Near the community where I serve, there used to be several factories, you know, and I'll have patients like mostly older African-American men in, say, like their 50s or 60s who will be like, you know, growing up in here, my dad worked at a factory and he made, you know, like $15 an hour doing manual labor. Why should I go and get a job making minimum wage, you know, making less than he did 50 some years ago? Frankly, that's hard to argue with.
Angela, do you see these disparities in the community that the Kedzie Center serves? Do you see the lack of resources, a lack of understanding, a lack of connection and accessibility for mental health services to poor and working class communities?
I would say that across the city, there's limited access to culturally informed quality mental health care. Some of that is because low-income communities of color often have limited insurance options. So, for example, if they have Medicaid-managed care, there are a number of clinics and clinicians who don't accept Medicaid-managed care. So they're limited to the number of places they can go. They also often have difficulty finding services in their native language or services that recognize their cultural experiences. And so Kedzie has worked really hard to be a place where we can offer services in multiple languages in a culturally informed way. And we're able, because of the way that we're funded, we're able to see people who are either underinsured or uninsured. And that's made an enormous difference in the community.
I'm wondering if either of you would like to respond to this question from both of your perspectives. Just the disparity in accurate diagnosis seems to also be a problem from the very beginning. Jonathan, your thoughts?
Yeah. You know, I think one of my duties at the community mental health clinic I work at is to do intake interviews. And it's not uncommon for me to welcome a new client and they've had like a few brief interactions with mental health services in the past. Maybe they've been hospitalized a few times or, you know, they've seen a psychiatrist for a short period of time. And they'll come in and they'll be like, yeah, you know, I have schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, PTSD, and depression. And in the back of my head, I'm like, well, I don't think you have all of those. You know, but there is really just chronic overdiagnosis, I think, of particularly communities of color. And there's been some research that shows that people of color are more apt to get diagnosed with, like, say, schizophrenia. People, you know, who are like white or of another majority culture are more apt to get diagnosed with like major depression with psychosis.
For the same symptoms, but they're diagnosed differently because of race.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm also curious about the quality of care in general for a lot of the folks, the population that we're talking about. Again, for our listeners, largely low-income working class, communities of color, refugees, immigrants, et cetera. The quality of care that one receives generally for things like this, are people being over-medicated? Are they being under-medicated in addition to inaccurate diagnoses?
I think that sometimes the overdiagnosis or misdiagnosis is often related to cultural interpretations. There are behaviors or things that we might see that if we don't understand the culture well enough, we might misinterpret. So I think that's one of the issues. The other thing is I think that we've been missing trauma for a long time. So there are a lot of things that, you know, it's very common for people to call ADHD. A lot of times the symptomatology looks the same.
Yes.
So it's really important to have like a very full assessment. Sometimes it could take 3 or 4 sessions and lots of sources of information. So I think that's another contributing factor. The third one would be that we sometimes fail to understand some of the psychosocial circumstances of our clients. So, for example, you know, are we considering poverty and are we considering marginalization and how those impact their mental health presentation? In terms of medication, because we're misdiagnosing, I would say that it's probably likely that people are being over-medicated. And we often get clients like Kedzie where our psychiatrist will review their records and often see 3 or 4 medications and try to really sort of narrow it down to, like, what does this client really need? And oftentimes, they actually need an opportunity to talk about their trauma.
Angela Cedeño is the executive director of the Kedzie Center, and Jonathan Foyles is a writer and mental health professional. Both work in Chicago. Thanks to you both for being here.
Thank you for having us.
And thanks to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for working with us on this week's coverage of how health outcomes are linked to race and zip code. And you can find the whole series of conversations at thetakeaway.org/healthatlas. All last week, global health leaders met in Amsterdam to discuss the fight against HIV/AIDS. But leading up to it, indigenous organizers held their own summit. Issues like poverty, discrimination, and geographic isolation can contribute to higher rates of HIV among indigenous populations, making it an ongoing public health crisis for these communities. Sean Hillier is a professor at Toronto's York University, where he teaches in the School of Health Policy and Management, and he's a member of the Halapu First Nation.
For the past 3 years, I conducted research in First Nations across the province of Ontario and Canada, mainly in northern communities. And I interviewed 29 Indigenous people using what we call a storytelling methodology. So based in ceremony and culture, trying to really gain the voice of individuals living with HIV. And one of the main themes that came out of this research was around a lack of access to education and community surrounding HIV. And many times, these participants faced violence as a result of their HIV diagnosis. And once the community found out, many were forced to leave their community due to varying issues, but substantially many talked about stigma, discrimination, violence that they faced as a result of being diagnosed with HIV.
And one of the reasons we're looking at this issue is because it feels that it doesn't get a lot of attention, particularly when it comes to Native communities and Indigenous communities. And I want to throw out some numbers here to see what you have to say about that. In Canada, Indigenous people make up just 4.3% of the population, but they account for 21% of new HIV infections. Indigenous people are also 3 times as likely to have HIV. What do you see, Sean, that's sort of leading that infection rate?
When we look at the reasons behind this, one of the takeaways I have is that this is really steeped in colonialism, colonial policy, and the traumas that Indigenous people have suffered for generations. So we look at specifically in Canada around residential schools where children were forcibly removed out of their communities and placed into these residential schools where they were sexually abused, physically abused, emotionally abused. They lost their culture, their languages, and then many were either sent back to their community where they had kind of no connection with their family anymore, or they were put on buses and sent to urban centers. And so when we look at this, we connect that loss of culture, of identity, of language back to trauma that has been experienced. And so what we see are lots of Indigenous people dealing with negative emotions, and they're doing that by using negative coping mechanisms. And so they're turning to drugs, they're turning to alcohol. We see the pattern of sexual abuse continuing. And so substantially, Indigenous people are being exposed to HIV through intravenous drug use, through sex work, through sexual assault at substantially greater rates than the general population. And so when we look at many of these issues, we have to look at them in the colonial context of which they're born. And we have to say, you know, Indigenous people in Canada are, you know, many of them live in deplorable conditions. And until we start to fix some of those underlying issues, we really aren't going to see substantial changes in terms of what we would expect is that the HIV infection rate will continue to rise in these communities.
And one of the things that has obviously changed since we first learned about the HIV/AIDS disease and virus is that we now have drugs that allow people to live longer. And I'm curious, are those accessible to Indigenous communities in Canada?
So in Canada, we have what's called non-insured health benefits. And so as an Indigenous person, I can go and get a prescription for PrEP. And that's something the federal government would pay for. However, we're talking about in remote communities, people who are diagnosed with HIV many times lack basic access to care where they, you know, need to fly out multiple times on planes for hours at a time in order to see their specialist, that, you know, there's a bad winter storm and their drugs don't come in. And so they're off their antiretrovirals or ART treatment for days, weeks, months. We're also looking at, when we talk about PEP and PrEP, people don't have the basic knowledge around HIV prevention. So there's a long way to go to even get to the point of PEP or PrEP, because we're still struggling to get people diagnosed and to keep them on treatment.
Sean Hillier is an Indigenous scholar and professor at Toronto's York University. Sean, thanks for your insights.
Thank you so much.
Today, an American icon turns 50 years old.
I'm going to show you how McDonald's builds a Big Mac sandwich.
It was August of 1968 when Americans got their first taste of a McDonald's Big Mac.
It starts here with a lightly toasted bun. And then a pure beef hamburger. Sizzling hot, a slice of cheddar blend cheese, crisp, fresh lettuce, our own secret sauce, the club slice, toasted, another hamburger, a little more sauce, crisp dill pickles, and the sesame seed crown, McDonald's new Big Mac sandwich for the bigger than average appetite.
That burger sold for 49 cents in 1968, and today you can pretty much get the same burger for $3.99. But in a 2016 memo to fellow operators, one top company franchisee worried that the Big Mac, quote, had gotten less relevant because only one in five millennials had tried the signature burger, the memo said. So is it really a happy birthday for the Big Mac, and is McDonald's still relevant? Jane Black is a food writer covering sustainability, business, and the politics of food. Jane, welcome.
Thanks a lot.
When the Big Mac hit the market in 1968, what was the reception like?
I mean, it was a huge hit. I mean, the thing is like a lot of other innovations at McDonald's and other fast food chains, this came from one of their franchisees, and it was a guy named Jim Delegati, and he later admitted that it was a bit of a knockoff from a sandwich at the Big Boy chain, but he begged them to let him test it at one of his restaurants in Pittsburgh. And they said, okay, you can do it at the one restaurant, provided that you use our standard bun. And it didn't quite work. So he snuck in a bigger sesame seed bun. And almost instantly, the Big Mac boosted sales by about 12%. And it took a year later, and it went national. And now about 550 million Big Macs are sold in the United States alone.
Now, that sounds like a good number, but we're seeing that McDonald's is also experiencing decades of growth globally in particular. But how are they doing overall in the United States? That's a lot of Big Macs, but does it make a difference for the company?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that McDonald's is really trying to reposition itself and has over the last 3 years. They got a new CEO 3 years ago, and they have been in the midst of a very big turnaround. I mean, I think Big Mac is a classic. I mean, there are times, I don't eat McDonald's very often, but there are times where you see a McDonald's and you just think, oh yeah, that would be great right now. And it tastes exactly the same as it did when, you know, I was a teenager, for good and for bad, obviously. But I think, you know, they are trying a lot of different things, but they are struggling a little bit in the U.S. I mean, they are having very good growth overseas. They're opening more stores, but they're closing some stores here in the U.S. And in their last earnings report, which was just a couple of months ago, we saw that their sales were higher, but it was really fueled by higher prices rather than more people coming to the stores. And that's really what you want to see when you look at a fast casual chain.
We're talking about McDonald's and their place in the fast food landscape. Landscape with writer Jane Black. Jane, you just said something that I think a lot of people, particularly Americans, feel when they see the Golden Arches is, that could be kind of good right now. Maybe I shouldn't admit it. Are there more, has that become part of the conversation around McDonald's, that it's not healthy?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, one of the things that I think about McDonald's is that it's a stand-in for all things big and bad. I mean, McDonald's really isn't, in many cases, the worst offender when it comes to all the things we think are bad about fast food, whether it's health, whether it's workers, labor force issues, all kinds of things like that. But McDonald's is the classic fast food chain. So we use McDonald's as shorthand for that kind of thing. But I do think it's important to be a little bit skeptical of this idea that it's all of these new kinds of fast food, more sustainable fast food, small chains. You know, Shake Shack is something that people talk about all the time. And they say, Shake Shack is really changing everything and McDonald's needs to watch out. I mean, you need to think about how many Shake Shacks there are. They are on a very aggressive growth plan, and their hope is to have 200 stores by the end of the year. McDonald's has almost 15,000 stores in the United States. So while it's changing the conversation, I don't think it's really affecting McDonald's bottom line at this point. In fact, one of the things that is happening, you know, in the micro, you know, with the quarterly earnings is that chains like Taco Bell or Burger King are really pushing breakfast. And it isn't that people are all going to Shake Shack. It's that, instead of always going to McDonald's for breakfast, you know, now they're going to stop at Burger King once in a while.
Well, and there's also the price point difference. I mean, here in New York, first of all, when you go to a Shake Shack, the line is, you know, usually really long, which is a deterrent, at least for me. Mm-hmm. And the price point is a lot higher than going into McDonald's. I mean, McDonald's, I think, is also, and I'm wondering if your research has shown this, but it's also something that is affordable for a lot of Americans who are on a budget. And, you know, that's something I think that gets lost in the conversation about this particular type of food.
Yeah, I think even in the era of Donald Trump, where we have become very aware of the difference between coastal America and middle America, blue America, red America, however you choose to shorthand it, it is a very coastal and New York conversation that people are moving in droves to eat vegan hamburgers or vegan burgers and all salads. I mean, McDonald's is everywhere, and it is part of the fabric of daily life in America, or fast food is in general. And I think that it's a really fun story to think of, you know, this new kind of cool, sexy upstart overturning things. But there's a long way to go on that.
And also, you know, we do have, I'm wondering how much of McDonald's political history has played into some of the maybe lack of excitement around millennials and McDonald's.
There are a lot of different issues there. So let's separate them out. So there's the labor issue. I mean, if you read Fast Food Nation, which came out 10, 15 years ago, I can't remember exactly, you know, it basically went through all of these abuses that, you know, fast food companies, you know, take advantage of, you know, cheap workers and all these kind of things. And so, you know, these are things that are more and more important among millennials, who are considered value consumers. I mean, they're looking for brands they can identify with. They're looking for brands that make them feel good about who they are. They've really internalized this idea of voting with your dollar. So they want to know what's going on. And I think that, you know, McDonald's is trying to do the right thing, but it's this huge battleship. They're trying to turn it around. For them to change anything, you know, when you're buying 1.6 billion pounds of beef a year, it's going to take a lot of work, and the change is going to be incremental.
Jane Black writes about food politics, trends, and sustainability. Jane, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And listeners, we really want to hear from you. What's your relationship like with McDonald's? Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Hi, my name is Karen. I'm calling from Richmond, Virginia. I remember as a young kid growing up, being on a budget, and going to McDonald's was always a treat for our family of four, and we always got the Big Mac, shared a big thing of fries and a Coke, made us so happy. So it's kind of cool for this 58-year-old who remembers going to McDonald's.
My name is Michael Lawrence from Richmond, Virginia. I do get the nostalgic, oh shoot, I could really use a McDonald's right now. Every time I do it, I regret it. The food is like a brick that just sits in my stomach. So I actually try to stay away from McDonald's, although I still love the fries, and I will sometimes treat myself to one of their sundaes.
It's August. I can't believe it. I don't know if you can believe it, but we're already halfway through the summer, and one thing that gets me through these hot, sweaty months is a really good soundtrack. Some of my favorite summer songs include Roy Ayers' Everybody Loves the Sunshine, Daft Punk, Get Lucky, and we can go on and on and on, but we knew you would have some summer picks, and here's what's on your summer playlist, past and present.
It's summertime, 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 summertime.
I love the song Sweater Weather.
My favorite summertime song this week is Mermaider.
Favorite song this summer has to be Childish Gambino's Summertime Magic.
You feel like summertime.
Stone Soul Picnic by the Fifth Dimension.
Holiday in Cambodia by the Dead Kennedys, because irony.
Hi, takeaway. My favorite summer song of all time is Brown Eyed Girl by Van Morrison.
A lot of great picks there from all of you. We really appreciate you sending those in. And I have to say, as a brown-eyed girl, I love brown-eyed girl. But to really assess what makes the best summer jams, I'm turning to an expert on this one. Jason Bentley is the music director for KCRW and the host of KCRW's Morning Becomes Eclectic. Hey, Jason.
Hi, Tanzina.
All right, so let's have some fun. It's the middle of summer, and we're talking about summer songs. And so we asked our listeners for some of their picks. I'll have a pick, but first I want to talk about some of your picks. And the first one you sent us over was Leon Bridges, If It Feels Good, Then It Must Be. Let's take a quick listen.
It must be bad how much I want you. Baby, if it feels good, then it must be bad how much I want you.
So Jason, I'm already jamming to this and I hadn't even heard it before. Why is this one of your picks?
Well, it's a jump up record, right? I mean, you just got to move. You feel it right away. Hotter Than Texas, and that's where he's from, Leon Bridges. And this is his sophomore album, so a lot of buzz around this young man.
A lot of fun. I like the feel. I like the vibe. It's a sunny day. All right, let's go to Dirty Projectors, I Feel Energy featuring Amber Mark. This one doesn't feel as poppy and as summery to me. Tell me why this is one of your picks.
Well, I don't know about you, but I can't help but start moving my shoulders and my head, you know, that kind of gravitational pull. So that's a great qualifier for any summertime anthem. This project is from David Longstreth. It's sort of a collective of musicians. And also, he features a guest vocalist on this song. Her name is Amber Mark, and when I spoke to him recently in an interview on KCRW, he mentioned that he discovered Amber through KCRW, which is what I love to hear. So, good stuff from Dirty Projectors, and I don't know, I feel the energy.
You're digging it. All right, all right. I think that's really cool, too, the KCRW connection. All right, so we're going to hear your third pick for the summer, and this one is a name many of us know. It's Paul Simon. Name of the song is That Was Your Mother, and this is a remix from the Graceland remixes. Let's take a listen.
A long time ago, before you was born, when I still sing, job as a traveling salesman that kept me moving from state to state. Well, I'm standing on the corner of Lafayette, state of Louisiana, wondering where a city boy could go.
Jason, I'm liking this remix a lot. I'm digging it.
Well, remixes, is especially of someone like Paul Simon and his stature, you know, it's a slippery slope. You know, sometimes it's just like, don't go there. It doesn't need to be remixed. But in this case, a Brazilian producer named Gui Barato, who's been around for a while on the global scene, did a great tasteful job with Sacred Ground here, this Paul Simon song from Graceland.
All right, so my pick, as hip as I try to be, and probably by using the word hip, I've just disqualified myself there. But my secret favorite song this summer is by none other than Miss Cardi B. Let's take a listen.
Now, I like
dollars, I like diamonds, I like stunning, I like shining, I like $1 million deals, where's my pen, bitch, I'm signing. I like those Balenciagas, the ones that look like socks, I like going to the jeweler, I put rocks all in my watch.
So few people can deny the greatness of the goddess Cardi B. Jason, what do you think about her rise and just this jam? I mean, it's not, I Like It Like That is not a new song. This is also a Cardi B remix, but what do you think? Are you into it?
You know, I like Cardi B. She won me over earlier this year. I saw her at Coachella out here on the West Coast, and I just like her style. You know, it's undeniable, and she's got a great sense of humor, doesn't take herself too seriously. And so I got to tell you, I like her vibe.
I want to take a step back here because these are kind of personal favorites of ours and our personal picks. What is it that makes a summer song, Jason?
Well, I think the magic of music is it can mean so many different things to different people. But in terms of summer, I think it just has to catch that feeling, that freedom, you know, the promise of those months for people's lives where they just cut loose a little bit or slow it down, you know. So whatever that means to you, I think there's a song out there that matches the moment.
We also asked our listeners to tell us what some of their favorite summer songs were, and the one that was suggested to us by Sharon on Twitter is by Ella May, and it's called Boot Up. Jason, did you like Boot Up?
I like that vibe. You know, it kind of takes it down tempo, which for a lot of people in the summertime is right on point, especially the hot days, the hot weeks in the summer, where you just need something that kind of takes it down a notch for you because it's just too hot to move. That's actually a quality of one of my favorite summertime songs, which is Gershwin's Summertime from Porgy and Bess.
And this is a classic.
Obviously, that's been covered by a million people. You know, the authentic versions are the older versions by, like, say, Billie Holiday or Ella Fitzgerald. But I wanted to mention a more recent version by Angelique Kidjo. Where she kind of makes it her own. This is the Afro-pop artist, Angelique Kidjo. But in any case, this is a summer mixtape essential, maybe an opener to some DJ set somewhere, is Gershwin's classic Summertime.
Summer's still not over yet, so we'd love to encourage our listeners to keep sending us your favorite summer songs. And Jason, if you have any others, we're always open to hearing from you, too.
Well, I hope I've added a couple suggestions to everyone's summer mixtape for this year. And Tanzina, you know, out here in L.A., I'm your warm-up DJ every day in the L.A. area.
What?
I tee you up every single day and hand it off at noon here on KCRW.
That's fantastic. I love that.
I'm just getting the people ready for you at noon.
Let me tell you, man, I appreciate it so much. Jason Bentley is the music director for KCRW and the host of KCRW's Morning Becomes Eclectic. Jason, peace out.
Thanks, Tanzina.
And we love your summer songs, so please keep sharing them with us at 8778 My Take. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.